The ground had been broken on the planned Israeli settlement during the tenure of the previous prime minister. Houses had not yet been built, but the plans had been laid out for the tiny Jewish community just outside Nablus, a town north of Jerusalem, in the mostly Arab West Bank. Protests against the planned construction had been ongoing, some violent. Although the new Israeli government was wavering, its citizens who had bought the land were not. The land would be settled. It was just a matter of time. Nosur Aruk had other plans.
This is perfect, Fatah. Stop here.
The three PIO trucks trailing the big sedan also came to a stop along the hillside road. Aruk didn't wait for his phalanx of bodyguards to run up the hill and surround him. He jumped excitedly from his car, hurrying to the lead truck. Bryce Babcock got out after Aruk, his drooping face hanging in fleshy sheets of fear. With great reluctance, he trailed the terrorist down the hill. By the time the Interior Secretary caught up with the PIO leader, Aruk was already overseeing the unloading of the neutrino bomb from the rear of the truck.
Careful, do not damage it.
When the men finally slipped the bomb from the shadows in the rear of the truck, Babcock saw that the timer was down to 27 minutes. Like an anxious child, the Interior Secretary tugged at the back of Aruk's sleeve.
We should hurry.
We are. Get out of the way.
Shaking Babcock away, the PIO head herded his men up the hill. The Jewish settlement was to be built at the hill's plateau. String tied to posts that had been driven into the rocky ground indicated where the future foundations would be. Aruk brought his men through the field of scrubby green brush and white and gray boulders to the very heart of the future development. Snapping the string with a thick boot heel, he ushered the men into the living room of a home that would never be built.
There, that flat rock.
Aruk climbed down to his knees, helping the men balance the bomb on the rock. Babcock grew more ill when he looked at the timer. 4 more minutes had drained away.
A statement to those who would steal Palestinian land. If only this area was inhabited.
Hurry!
This time, Aruk didn't resist. When the PIO leader got to his feet, the Interior Secretary's relief was obvious. With one last longing glance at the neutrino bomb, Aruk led the charge back to the waiting cars. When they cleared the edge of the flat hilltop, a vision more terrifying than an endangered condor egg omelet greeted Bryce Babcock down the slope. An Israeli convoy had parked behind the PIO vehicles. Curiosity had led them to investigate. But when the armed PIO contingent burst into view, the spark of alarm charged through the Israeli forces. The PIO soldiers skidded to a stop, reflexively aiming their weapons down the hill.
We don't have time for this!
The PIO leader's eyes darted from the Israeli soldiers to his own men. The Palestinians didn't look at their leader. Their collective gaze was fixed on the hated soldiers below. For a moment suspended in time, nothing happened. Tension in the Mexican standoff grew to a pounding drum of fear in Bryce Babcock's ears. All at once, the head of the Palestine Independence Organization drew in a deep breath.
Fire!
And the PIO leader and the American Interior Secretary dove for cover. Remo had stolen a PIO pickup to replace his crippled Buick. The truck flew south, keeping the gas pedal flat to the floor. Remo drove like mad for the Israel border. He prayed Nosur Aruk wasn't taking the scenic route to the Jewish state. At speeds in excess of 90 miles per hour, they reached the border in less than 15 minutes. The soldiers on the Lebanon side wished to detain them. Two foreign nationals driving in what was likely a stolen Lebanese truck cried out for arrest. Remo convinced them to look the other way by breaking all their noses. Faces gushing blood, they waved the two men through. On the other side of the border, the young Israeli border guard checked Remo's and Chun's phony passports. The guard was all of 18 years old.
Has Nosur Aruk been through here?
He passed through a few minutes ago.
Did you search his car?
There were 4 vehicles in his motorcade. We let them all go through without inspection.
Are you nuts? The guy's a terrorist.
We have standing orders from the new government. We are not to create an incident with him.
What if I told you he plans to blow up your country?
He'd have to get in line. You may proceed.
You at least have any idea where he might have gone?
He has an office in Hebron, in the West Bank.
They raced down the road into Israel. Bryce Babcock felt like one of the precious crocodiles his department had released in a downtown Kansas City park back in 97. They'd been shot at too. Babcock and Arouk had taken cover behind a pear-shaped boulder. Chunks of stone and clouds of pebbly dust pelted their heads and backs.
We can't stay this close to the bomb! Your colleague said it had a short range. This will be over soon. We are safe!
No, we're not! There could be a radiation leakage problem before the bomb even goes off. It has a plutonium charge. If the shell gets pierced by a bullet while we're still in range, we could all end up with radiation poisoning.
I had not thought of that. I suppose we could attempt escape?
How?
My car! It is closer than the trucks!
With saucering eyes, Babcock peeked around the side of the boulder. When he dropped back down beside Arouk, he was shaking his head violently.
That's gotta be a city block away!
An eighth of a mile, perhaps a little less.
Arouk reluctantly unholstered his handgun. As he was rising to a squat, Babcock grabbed his arm.
We'll both be killed!
Do you know how to drive?
Yes.
In that case, do not talk! Run!
Babcock had no desire to follow, but he was more terrified of dying alone. Shaking in fear, he made an instant, albeit reluctant, decision. Jumping out from behind the rock, he followed the terrorist at a gallop through the deadly crossfire. Remo stopped the first Arab they passed.
Hey! Seen Noso Arouk in the past hour or so?
The traitor took the road to Nablus. He thinks we do not know him in his bulletproof car.
Nablus, you know where that is, Chun?
Am I now a walking atlas?
Please, little father.
Yes, I do. But I am getting you a globe for your next birthday.
Beats pasting Stan Ronaldman's ratty wig in my scrapbook. And you're assuming any of us is having another birthday.
Run, you fool! Run!
By favor of the blessed Earth Goddess herself, Bryce Babcock managed to survive the Israeli PIO crossfire. Shaking from panic and exertion, the Interior Secretary's shaking hand grabbed the silver handle of the driver's door. Before he could pull, he felt something hard press into his back. Babcock froze. A young Israeli soldier had sneaked up around the PIO vehicles in order to get behind the firing Palestinian soldiers. As his bladder drained down his leg once more, Bryce Babcock raised his hands numbly in the air.
Get in, fool!
Heart pounding, Babcock scrabbled for the door handle. Springing the door open, he fell behind the steering wheel. The keys were still in the ignition.
That way!
Obediently, Babcock steered the car in a wide arc. They headed back down the road toward the waiting line of Israeli soldiers. Babcock winced as the Jewish troops opened fire on the runaway car.
Do your worst! You will not pierce the skin of this mighty Palestinian beast!
They plowed through the line of soldiers. Although the men continued to fire from every direction at the escaping car, their weapons had no effect. Arouk bounced giddily from window to tinted window. Even though the men couldn't see him through the dark glass, he stuck out his tongue at them. In the front seat, Bryce Babcock's eyes were sick as he watched the display in the rearview mirror.
How can you be so calm?
Welcome to the Middle East.
The sturdy car raced down to the main winding dirt road. And on the rocky hill, high above them, the red digital timer on the stainless steel casing of the neutrino bomb continued to count remorselessly down to zero. They hadn't gone much farther down the road before Remo felt a sudden, strange sensation through the tires of the truck. Whatever it was new to him and huge. Face a granite mask, he glanced at the master of Shinanju. Shun had felt it as well. Expression grave, his gaze was fixed on the distant hills. When he saw the look on his teacher's face, tension thinned Remo's lips. His own eyes scanned the far-off landscape.
It was too big for conventional explosives.
If it were nearby, we would have seen the flash.
Although both Shinanju masters were trying to gauge the direction from which the vibrations were coming, it was difficult to tell with an explosion of the magnitude they'd just felt. All the earth beneath them seemed to be trembling. It was Remo who first came to a tentative conclusion.
South?
The vibrations appear to be coming from that direction.
At the moment, they were driving south, fast.
Hang on!
As they fled, the cloud appeared over the darkening horizon. An unaccustomed tug of fear took hold of Remo the instant he saw it in the rearview mirror. It rose above the spin-out cloud the truck had made. Expanding across the pale desert sky, the fat blob of thick, thrown-up dirt was balanced atop a heavy stalk of pulverized earth until he saw the mushroom cloud. Remo had hoped he and Chun were wrong, but they were right. Someone had detonated the neutrino bomb. No escape. Too close. Screaming forward, the shockwave would reach them any second. In the side-view mirror, the master of Shinanju was watching the cloud rise higher in the sky. His weathered face betrayed awe and worry.
Faster!
I've got it flat out!
A sudden gust of wind burst forth across the desert. A violent artificial sandstorm. The cloud rushed forward, swallowing up the truck. The road before them vanished. Remo felt the truck pulling away from him. The wind had taken control of the vehicle. In an instant, they were being propelled ahead of the gale at speeds in excess of the indicator. The needle jumped impossibly to the farthest point on the speedometer and locked there. Remo felt like Dorothy caught in the twister. He fought to keep the truck under control. The windshield shattered.
Hold on!
Even a master of Shinanju was no match for so awesome a man-made force. The truck was lifted off its tires. Sand blew in through the vacant windshield. The truck hit something. A hill? The road? It was impossible to know. Through half-squinting eyes, Remo caught sight of the master of Shinanju. The old Korean was being thrown around the cab. From what little Remo could see, he appeared to be weathering the storm. Until the section of seat he was holding unexpectedly gave way. Chun's parchment face registered a brief instant of surprise. That was the last thing Remo saw before the violent wind grabbed hold of him.
Chun!
Just like that, he was gone. Remo felt his mouth fill with gritty sand. The twinge of fear he'd felt before exploded fully. Chun was gone. And in that moment of panic for his father in spirit, Remo allowed his concentration to lapse. He did not feel the steering wheel coming loose. It popped free without a sound. When he realized what had happened, it was already too late to do anything about it. The howling wind plucked him from the cab, lifting, flinging him roughly through the air. There was no time to think of Chun or of his own safety. Remo flew face first through the open windshield. And the swirling, ferocious sandstorm consumed him utterly. Baghdad's elite Republican Guard, pride of the Republic of Iraq, was on maneuvers in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley in the land once known as Mesopotamia. It was a special day for the highly trained soldiers. President, Prime Minister, and Chairman of the Revolutionary Command Council, Saddam Hussein himself, was on hand for the latest military exercises. Hussein sat in an open jeep above the field of battle. A frozen smile gripped his face beneath his bushy mustache as he reviewed his mighty troops through his field glasses. Hundreds of massive tank treads kicked up huge plumes of dust as the armored vehicles rumbled across the arid plain. Beyond them, a network of cunningly deceptive trenches had been dug by foot soldiers for this battlefield mock-up. From his vantage point, Hussein could see the men lined within the trenches awaiting the attack. The Gulf War had done much to deflate the confidence of the Republican Guard. Convinced that they were invincible, the soldiers had been stunned by the rapidity as well as the severity of the United States-led operation. It had been necessary in the years since for Hussein to rebuild the morale of his once feared army. Between the soldiers in their trenches and the approaching line of tanks, another group of men stood out in open desert. Tiny in comparison to the mechanized beasts, these soldiers bravely awaited the approaching vehicles. Hussein ran his binoculars along the ragtag collection of men, pitifully small in the vastness of the Iraqi desert. His smile broadened. Kurdish rebels, hundreds of them. The men hailed from the mountainous north of the Mideast nation. Hussein had slaughtered most of them several years before, but he had kept some alive for special occasions, like this one. The Kurds had not been given guns. They were armed only with knives. This was a sensible precaution, for only a fool would arm a Kurd, even for a battle simulation. After all, someone could get hurt. Ragged in their surplus Republican Guard uniforms, the Kurdish soldiers stood, bravely awaiting slaughter. The president of Iraq was dressed identically to all of the men below him, with one great, unseen exception. In the war with America, Any strip of white cloth available to the Iraqi troops had been employed as a flag of surrender. This included one uniform item in particular. That problem had been addressed by Saddam Hussein himself. In the newest incarnation of the elite Republican Guard, no underwear. Right now, Hussein's Fruit of the Looms were riding up on him as he shifted his ample rump on his hot leather seat. Tugging at his backside, he kept his binoculars as steady as possible. He didn't wish to miss one moment of the action. The tanks were rumbling close, only a few yards from the helpless men. The Kurds stood their ground. There was no point in running. They would be shot from behind if they tried. The great thundering rattle from the massive metal machines could be felt throughout the valley. Watching through his field glasses, Hussein chewed his mustache in gleeful anticipation. But as he watched, something odd seemed to happen. All at once, the air in the valley shimmered. It was as if the world for a moment turned slightly out of focus. As quickly as it had come, the disturbance passed. The desert wind picked up, blowing from the field of battle the plumes of smoke that had been rising from the treads of the approaching tanks. Hussein's olive skin was pelted with a fine spray of sand. A normal desert wind, that was all. No, not all. Something below him had changed. His precious tanks had stopped moving. All 200 of them were now frozen in place. Nothing seemed to happen for a long time. After a pregnant silence, a tank lid sprang open. It was followed by another, then another. Soldiers began to scurry out into the sunlight. Saddam Hussein turned to his coterie of subordinates.
What is happening? Why are they not grinding those Kurdish dogs beneath their treads?
Haste was made to learn the reason for the lack of tank movement in the field of battle. Far below, the Kurds were hesitating, unsure this wasn't some kind of trick. When the lack of movement continued for another handful of minutes, Hussein knew that it had gone on too long. Something was desperately wrong. The Kurds sensed it as well. Hundreds of Kurds, knives raised above their heads, swarmed toward the row of inert tanks. Behind the Kurds, the armed men in the trenches didn't act. They were a safety measure to keep the Kurds in line, yet they did nothing to stop them. When Hussein swung his binoculars over, he saw that the men in the trenches were struggling with their guns.
Shoot them! Order those fools to fire!
The man nearest him slammed the portable phone with his fist.
The radio does not work, my president!
The slaughter had already begun. Men fell to the sand. His men. Saddam Hussein's vaunted and feared Republican Guard. Men clutched bellies and throats. Blood flowed into the sand of their forefathers. The soldiers in the trenches still had not fired. Hussein realized with a horrid sinking feeling that the only reason they would not shoot was because they could not shoot. The Kurds finished with the tank soldiers in less than 3 minutes. Charged with the thrill of victory, knives dripping blood, they raced back for the men in the trenches. The Republican Guard soldiers had already stripped off their trousers. Naked from the waist down, they waved their pants in the air atop the barrels of their useless guns. The Kurds did not recognize their surrender. They had for too many years been victims of Iraq's celebrated Republican Guard. It was a massacre. In minutes, pools of dark blood stained the powdery sand in the trenches. Sickened by the spectacle, Hussein turned to his men, his face ashen.
Oh, let us leave!
The jeep does not work, my president!
Hussein's head whipped to the valley. Below, the Kurds were almost finished with the slaughter. There was only one place left for them to go. And with a sinking feeling, Hussein knew where that was. Throwing his binoculars to the sand, Chairman of the Revolutionary Command Council, Saddam Hussein, spun from the field of battle and ran like a jackrabbit for home. In his haste to run back to Baghdad, he did not even bother to pick at his wedged underpants. Two Soviet-built MiG-23s raced along the sticky black tarmac of the Syrian Arab People's Airport in the low-lying hills south of Damascus. Fuselages shuddered as the cooler mountain air grabbed the swing wings of both planes. With a piercing cry, the airport fell away and the powerful jets screamed into the heavens. At one time, the Syrian Air Force had 70 of the aircraft. But in the wake of the Soviet Union's collapse came a serious equipment shortage. Parts were being scavenged from donor planes just to keep the dwindling aircraft of the Syrian Air Force alive. These were two of the last complete multi-role all-weather fighters of this type still in service. The MiGs left Damascus far behind, soaring along the lower hills of the anti-Lebanon mountains. Hugging the mountains to the east, the MiGs soared in the direction of the disputed Golan Heights. Sunlight glinted off the cockpit domes. In spite of speeds nearly exceeding 1,500 miles per hour, Mount Hermon seemed not to move. It stayed patiently beside the roaring fighters as they flew, an ancient, watchful sentry. The routine patrol continued south as far as Asuwaida, then looped north for home. As the bleak terrain braced beneath the bellies of the twin planes, one of the pilots thought he saw something in his peripheral vision. He glanced over his shoulder in the direction of Mount Hermon. The mountain seemed to shiver. Behind his goggles, the pilot blinked his eyes. When he looked back, Hermon was stationary once more, as if nothing had happened. But something had. The MiG began to lose altitude. Looking over, the pilot saw that his sister craft was in the same predicament. Nose dipping forward, it had begun an inexorable screaming dive for the lowland mountains. The plane was going down. The pilot hit the eject switch. Nothing happened. He hit it again. Still nothing. The ground was racing up now. Faster, faster. He was pounding the switch, banging his hands against the dome above his head. Nothing moved. Everything was fused. The ground was visible on the other side of the dome. It was in front of the nose. Too fast. Too fast. The scene played out the same way from Cyprus to Saudi Arabia, from Egypt to the west of Iran. Afterward, some claimed they had felt something. All said they saw something. A strange shimmering of the land, followed by a warm wind. Guns seized up at a rally in Lebanon. King Abdullah's plane nearly crashed during takeoff in Jordan. Elevators, automobiles, kitchen appliances, construction equipment. Indeed, all metal-on-metal hardware within at least a 700-mile radius around Israel's disputed West Bank became inoperative, as if clenched in a powerful, invisible fist. And around the world, stunned governments nearly tripped over one another as they sprang to sudden action, all of them with the same goal, to gain a foothold in the suddenly powerless region. Their car suddenly seized up on the road into Hebron. Behind the wheel, Bryce Babcock desperately turned the key, at the same time pressing his foot on the gas. Nothing happened. Not an engine struggling sound, not a feeble click. Nothing.
The peace bomb.
Give it more gas.
I already did.
You flooded the engine.
How could I? We were driving fine. It just stopped. It must be the neutrino wave.
Oh, now what am I supposed to do? I cannot walk back to my office. They will slaughter me in the street.
What about this stuff?
Babcock lifted a few articles of clothing that had been left on the seat by Fatong and the other bodyguard. Aruk's facial stubble gathered into a prickly frown. Reluctantly grabbing the clothes, the PIO head improvised a disguise. Aruk abandoned his beloved checkered family keffiyeh for a more traditional, less cumbersome head wrapping. A pair of dark sunglasses obscured his crazed, unblinking eyes. That was it. On another man, two minor changes like these wouldn't have mattered, but on Nosur Aruk, they managed to obliterate his two most distinctive features.
I shame my ancestors to dress like this.
Nosur Aruk stuffed his beloved head covering inside his wrinkled fatigue jacket. Disguise in place, he grabbed the door handle. The door refused to budge.
What is this devilry?
The neutrino wave would have fused virtually all metal on metal.
So how do we get out?
It took 20 more minutes and the removal of the back seat. On their backs, both men were able to kick open the sedan's trunk. Sweating profusely, they climbed out the back and onto the rock-strewn street.
What's that noise?
It sounds like a mob. But if it is, it is not like any I have ever heard before.
The two men headed off into the city, threading their careful way to Aruk's Hebron office. They had not gone far before they found the source of the noise. Aruk had been right. It was a mob, and it was also unlike any he had ever seen in his lifetime.
They are not using guns.
Well, they wouldn't work either. Metal on metal, remember?
The crowd had formed a semicircle around a short, garbage-strewn alley. The center of attention, an emaciated old man, stood at the far end of the lane. Men had gathered up chunks of crumbling buildings and roads, hurling the rocks at the cowering, bleeding old man. Aruk indicated a man who had just joined the crowd.
He has a gun.
The man aimed his weapon. Aruk watched with interest. The gun blew up in the man's hands, ripping them to shreds. The crowd didn't notice. Their stone throwing had reached a fever pitch. The pathetic old man surrendered to the jagged rocks without so much as a sigh. He died in a bloody heap at the rear of the alley. Aruk turned to Babcock. When he peeked over his sunglasses, there was sad understanding in his eyes.
No guns?
I told you.
Oh, but this was to be the Great Holy War. The Jews have lost their teeth. Detonating that bomb was a symbol for my people to rise up for a free Palestine. How can we have a proper jihad without arms?
Please, Nasser, it wasn't supposed to be this way. This was supposed to be for the good. Like when I set those lepers loose in Pennsylvania, if you'd only surrender to the loving embrace of peace, all will be well.
Peace is for those who have not the stomach for war. And for your sake, my beloved missile had better work.
Whirling from Babcock, he hurried from the mob, heading deeper into the city. Casting a last frightened look at the bloody dead man, Bryce Babcock hustled in Aruk's wake. The desert storm screamed off into the arid hills where it had been born and was gone. Remo had concentrated on weightlessness during his time hurled through the air, and so was feather light when he finally landed softly on his stomach, a quarter of a mile back from the spot where the forward rush of air from the neutrino bomb had caught his truck. The wind had not yet died away before he sprang up. Unharmed, his worried eyes scanned for the master of Shinanju. He found him immediately. The old Korean was up and padding across the desert toward him, his face a stony frown.
Your driving skills are appalling. If you wish me dead so that you may assume reigning masterhood, please tell me. I would rather send myself home to the sea than participate in any more of your one-man demolition derbies.
Don't start on my driving again. Even you can't possibly blame me for that.
Perhaps. Nevertheless, you are crashing carriages with alarming frequency of late. When we return home, I am enrolling you in a driver's education program.
Look who's talking. Ted Kennedy laughs at your driving.
Remo looked back to the point they both knew to be ground zero. The mushroom cloud was dissipating into thin smears of puffy lines above the hills. Even the wind was dying down.
I guess we were far enough away to avoid the radiation.
It is in the air.
Not bad. The sun on a weak ozone day.
Nonetheless, we should leave this area.
Remo nodded. They walked a half mile down the road when they came upon what was left of their truck. The roof was crushed as if beneath a dinosaur's foot. The bed was twisted to a right angle from the cab. One axle had snapped. Half of it, along with the attached tire, was missing altogether.
I guess we really don't need it anymore anyway. It's pretty obvious we won't be bringing the neutrino bomb back with us.
What of the Emperor in exile?
Yeah, the President. He was going after Aruk. If we're lucky, we'll find both of them together, assuming we can scrape up transportation.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Eyebrow arched, Chun nodded down the road. When Remo turned, he saw that a group of men on camelback was riding in from the north. They had seen the cloud and survived the terrifying gust of wind, and were now coming to investigate the cause of the strange phenomenon. When Remo turned back to Chun, he was shaking his head.
I am not riding one of those things.
We haven't a choice.
And I thought, thanks to Master Nakoop, that you didn't like mountain monsters or hill humps or whatever the hell the Shinanju scrolls call camels.
Hush. I'm about to negotiate with Bedouins, the most crafty and avaricious hagglers in the world, and I do not need your constantly flapping lips as a distraction.
Yeah, well, I hope you have a plan.
Of course I do.
The old Korean waited patiently for the men to arrive. Remo stood beside him, tapping his foot on the road. There were nine of them, all dressed in traditional robes and keffiyehs. They slowed their beast near the pair of strange pedestrians. Faces dark as a desert night, their suspicious eyes peered out over sand-coated veils.
Greetings. My son and I require two of these fine animals. Remo, pay the nice men.
Some plan.
Remo dug in his pocket, removing a wad of bills. Apparently, the Bedouins didn't have a problem with American currency. Remo peeled off several hundred dollars, handing the bills to the eager men. Two camels were separated from the rest. The master of Shinanju scampered quickly under the hump of the larger beast.
Try not to crash this, lead-footed one.
With a twist of the reins and a kick of Chum's heels, the camel began to trot down the road.
I'll crash you.
Grabbing a fistful of fur, Remo pulled himself onto the hump. Grinding his heels into the animal's sides, he sent his camel after that of the master of Shinanju. Though the media liked to think he had slept straight through his 8 years in office, save, of course, the single time he managed to pad, yawning, down to the Oval Office to approve a secret arms deal to a fundamentalist Islamic nation, the former president of the United States had been as attentive as his post would allow. As luck would have it, he remembered from White House briefings that the main office of the Palestine Independence Organization was in Hebron. Unfortunately, it was also miles away across hostile terrain. A stolen robe and headdress had gained him anonymity after his harrowing escape from his PIO captors in Lebanon. The features that peeked out around his veil had not brought unwanted attention. His dark tan and weathered skin were common enough for men in this part of the world. A stolen jeep and dumb luck helped him slip across the border from Lebanon into Israel. His biggest problem came once he was inside the Jewish state. His jeep ran out of gas. Carrying his disguise in a lumpy bundle beneath one arm, he was forced to continue on foot. He hadn't gone far before he was spotted by a border patrol. Fortunately, in another lifetime, the president had been a bit of a thespian. His acting skills had come in handy when he was being questioned by the soldier. The former president claimed to be an American tourist who was visiting Israel with his wife. He said he had become separated from the rest of his bus tour. The soldier was very young, so young he failed to recognize the old man standing before him. After admonishing the tourist for his carelessness, the soldier drove him back to within a few miles of the disputed West Bank, where the president claimed his tour bus was scheduled to arrive any minute. After the soldier had gone, the president donned his Arab disguise once more and headed into the West Bank. As he made his way through the busy streets, the former president caught a few curious glances from passersby. In his robe, with head and face covered, he was dressed rather formally for the disputed zone. Most Arabs in the area were comfortable wearing a simple open shirt and slacks. However, in spite of the interest some might have had, they left the president alone.
Arush's office. Arush's office.
He wasn't quite sure where to go. For some reason, he seemed to think it was on the south side of Hebron. The buildings were all at least 3 stories tall and set directly on the roads. They lent a feeling of intense claustrophobia to the narrow streets. The president pushed himself forward. He felt the strain of labor burning in his lungs. His heart pounded. Muscles ached from effort. He was exhausted. 10 years before, this would have been a grueling test of endurance. But at his current age, and after all he'd recently been through, it was nearly too much for him. It was a struggle to move on. But he had to. Nosur Aruk had the neutrino bomb. The PIO leader had to be stopped. As he trudged on, puffing ragged breaths through his sweat and saliva-soaked veil, the president thought ruefully how much easier it would have been for him 15 years ago. Back then, all he would have had to do was pick up the red phone in the White House. Smith would have answered, and within minutes, his men would be deployed. Aruk, Babcock, and the neutrino bomb all would have been stopped. But he could not live in the past. Smith's men were doubtless looking for him. The president himself had seen to that. But they might not know where he had ended up. They could still be wandering around the California hospital. No, the president was here, now, the only man who knew what was going on. The only man who could make a difference in time. Trying to run. More of a hobble.
Thunder?
The buildings around him seemed to shimmer. For a moment, it looked as if they might flicker away altogether, fading into the desert, joining the dust of countless civilizations that had squatted for a brief time beneath the same heartless sun, only to be absorbed by the sand. Wind followed, strong, but not fierce, kicking up great clouds of dust in the narrow passageway between the tightly lined buildings. The dust began to settle moments later. Even before it had, the president knew he was too late. Tiny battered cars stopped dead on the street around him. Their drivers could not get them to start again. The anarchy would come quickly. He was too late. There was nothing more he could do here. The president turned, hurrying back the way he had come. He would get back to Israel, to safety. Aruch hadn't dropped the bomb to Hebron. The wind had been to the president's back. He had planted it somewhere closer to the border with Lebanon. After 45 minutes of running back and forth in this squalid city, he was growing dizzy from his exertions. The frustration of failure piled atop the strain of effort.
Old man, never should have tried, never should have taken the risk.
Even as he muttered the words, he knew they were wrong. They were foreign to him, not what he expected from himself. He had tried. He had failed, but he had tried. He was sweating profusely. The chaos in the streets was growing around him with each tortured step. Gangs were grabbing strangers. His heart pounded. His mind swirled. He couldn't breathe. Too much effort.
I have to stop. Have to rest, if only for a minute.
He paused against the side of a building at a quiet intersection, leaning against the hard wall. A wrinkled hand pulled the veil from his face only for a moment. Fresh air. He breathed deeply a few times. The air was like sandpaper on his raw throat. Still, it felt good. Refreshing. Bracing.
Oh, keep moving.
He pushed away from the wall, reaching to replace his veil as he did so. The president took a step around the corner and plowed directly into Nosur Aruch. Colliding with the rushing figure, the PIO leader was forced to take an awkward step back. He was slammed from behind by Bryce Babcock. When he saw whom he had bumped into, the whites of Aruch's eyes became visible above his dark sunglasses.
What is this?
The terrorist fumbled a curving dagger from a scabbard at his waist. He pressed the knife to the belly of the ex-president. The president was too out of breath to reply. He allowed the veil, which he had not yet fully reattached, to drop from his hand. It swung down to his shoulder.
No, put it on!
Nodding weakly, the elderly man did as he was told. Once his face was hidden, the PIO leader nodded.
I do not know how you got here, but you are coming with me, Ancient One.
With a shove, Nosur Aruch propelled his captive forward. The former president was too weak to resist. He allowed the PIO leader to guide him at knife point. Bryce Babcock fell in behind the others. Together, the unlikely trio hustled off through the growing chaos of Hebron. The master of Shinanju rode into the ancient city of Hebron like a conquering hero, perched carefully atop his magnificent desert brown camel. Remo's camel was struggling to keep up. It clomped on broad-toed, furry feet into the chaotic streets. It would have stopped running altogether if not for the judicious coaxing Remo occasionally applied.
Why is my camel so winded?
You are too fat. See how my beast accepts its precious feathery cargo with speed and grace.
It's as graceful as a friggin' camel, little father. We would have been better off saddling two pigs. I think mine has asthma.
Stop complaining. Camels all make similar noises.
Want a trade?
Why would I want your sick camel?
They rode deeper into the city. Packs of men with mischief as their purpose prowled the streets. Apartment windows had already been smashed on most buildings. Cars, whose engines had been frozen by the neutrino wave, sat abandoned in the middle of roadways. Molotov cocktails had been tossed into some of the vehicles. From the open car windows, orange flames licked up into plumes of thick black smoke. Remo was nearly shocked by the speed at which the inhabitants of the town had descended into feral behavior. But then he realized that, at least according to the regular images on the nightly news, they hadn't been too far away from it to begin with. Riding down a particularly ravaged street, a group of men took evil interest in Remo and Shun. One Arab with a board in his hand separated from the rest. He ran over to the master of Shinanju, waving the chunk of wood menacingly. With a toe kick to the nose, Shun sent the man sailing backward under the hood of a stalled car. After that, The crowd cut them a wide swath. In the next three city blocks, they passed 7 rock fights, 5 knife imbroglios, 3 immolations by fire, an impalement, 6 savage chain beatings, and 2 stonings.
It's nice these people haven't forgotten their roots.
Man has raised hand against his fellow man since the beginning of time. Be thankful it is so, for if it was not, we would be out of work. There.
The old Korean aimed a tapered finger down the road to where the street curved away between tightly packed buildings. A group of 5 Arabs was working near a jeep.
What about them?
They are of the Arush clan.
How can you tell?
Do you not recognize the keffiyeh?
One dirty dish rag's the same as the next to me.
Observe, oh educated one.
Using his ankles, the master of Shinanju gently pinched his camel's furry hump. The beast lowered obediently to the ground. Shun had no sooner slid off the animal than he was marching over to the Arabs. Remo's camel wasn't at all obliging. Even though he copied Chun's technique exactly, the animal only spit and snorted. It even twisted its head around, trying to bite him. He finally gave up altogether and hopped to the ground. He trotted up beside the master of Shinanju.
I miss having a car.
Cars are filthy inventions.
Camels are filthier, and I never had a Chrysler try to bite me on the leg.
The Arabs heard them talking. The men had been fussing about, attempting to figure out why the jeep would no longer run. But at Remo and Chun's approach, they grew instantly alert. AK-47s had been abandoned to the hood of the car. They grabbed them now, brandishing the weapons like clubs. One of them swung his gun toward Chun's head. Unfortunately for the Arab, the rifle failed utterly to make contact with the intended skull. The man watched in horrified wonder down the length of his gun as the side of one of his comrades' heads collapsed into a visible V-shape. Somehow, the man had moved into the spot previously occupied by the ancient intruder. When the last of his companions fell to the ground at the front of the jeep, the Arab looked up, his eyes sick.
We need a tour guide. You're it.
Oh, I will lead you to the very border of hell and beyond.
PIO headquarters will do.
Anything you wish.
Remo, lash this dog to the reins of your camel that he might precede us to the Evil One's lair.
Nodding, Remo grabbed hold of the Arab and began to drag him back down the street. He took only 2 steps before he noticed that his camel was nowhere to be seen. Only Chun's animal remained. Remo stopped dead.
Hey, my camel's gone!
Tether the Arab to your neck for all I care. Just do not let him get away.
Leaving Remo to deal with their guide, the master of Shinanju marched quickly down the street, lest Remo get any designs for his own mount. The doorknob had fused to a solid mass on the front of the Palestine Independence Organization building. Luckily, a few of Aruk's men were loitering outside the building. They managed to pop the door open with a minimum of effort.
Get out of my way!
Aruk pulled his way through the mass of men and into the main hallway. The others followed him inside, propelling Bryce Babcock and the former president before them. Aruk led the parade to his office.
The day has arrived at long last.
Passing his cluttered desk, he breezed onto the veranda. Outside, Nosur Aruk didn't seek the help of his men. This was a special moment, one he wished to keep for himself. Like a selfish child with a birthday gift, he tore at the netting surrounding his precious rocket. It was difficult at first. Much of the camouflage remained stubbornly attached to the uppermost portion of the long rocket. A final mighty tug brought the entire plastic covering tumbling to the balcony. The missile was a slender white tube with 2 sets of wings, one halfway down the length of the assembly, the other smaller pair near the tail. A stabilizing dorsal fin extended from the rear. 2 sustainable ramjets were fixed to the dorsal and ventral sides of the missile. In addition to these, 4 jettisonable rocket boosters were attached in a fan arrangement around the housing.
Oh, she is beautiful, is she not?
That's a rocket!
A Bloodhound MK2, British long range. It will strike Jerusalem minutes after launch.
It won't work!
Do not attempt to talk me out of it! I have waited years for this glorious day.
That's not what I meant. The rocket won't work. It's metal on metal. The neutrino wave would have neutralized its working components.
You lie!
Please, no, sir. You saw the evidence out in the street with your own car. If you try to launch that thing, it will not go up. Worse, if some of its components survive the neutrino wave, it could detonate right here on the pad.
It could have survived?
No, it will never launch like it's supposed to. That's the whole point of the peace bomb. But some of the inner workings could have survived. Lead could have shielded some of the smaller metal parts. Silicon or plastic might have made it through. Enough might work in there to detonate whatever explosives are inside.
Nosur Aruk listened carefully to what was being explained to him. He made an instant decision. He pointed to one of his men.
You! Fire the missile in precisely 2 minutes!
While the PIO soldier stepped dutifully onto the balcony, Nosur Aruk hightailed it back inside. Running through the halls of the headquarters, he led his entourage, which still included Bryce Babcock and the former president, into the courtyard on the far side of the building.
Jews never did that!
Babcock said nothing more, fearful that he might inspire more anger in the PIO leader. Head shaking in disbelief, Aruk stared at the ruins of his headquarters. Only the back steps remained. He kicked at a piece of shattered brick.
What made this happen?
The peace bomb lets off a powerful magnetic force. It would have fused the missile to the platform. I explained all this to you before.
Yes. What is the effective range of your bomb?
No one's really sure. Could be a couple hundred miles.
This would be the same in all that area?
Yes.
So whoever gets weapons in this region of the world first will rule it.
We need guns, bullets, explosives, and a radio. One that will have survived your peace bomb.
None of them would have.
I will need money.
The PIO leader walked around Babcock to stand toe-to-toe with the president.
What do you think, old one? I am certain Iran would be interested in having you as a prize.
Libya would also pay a handsome price. For that matter, a dozen countries in this region. Many more around the world. You will make me the last great monarch of all the Mideast.
Why is it that little fellas like you always have such big mouths?
The PIO leader's smile vanished into his whiskers, replaced by a scowl. Wheeling to his men, he snapped a thumb to the president.
Take him! His worthless hide is as good as gold. We ride this hour to my ancestral land and to glory!